Have her sedated, said Clementine, and she's still intubated. She tripped on the terrifying word and thought of Ruby's white little face and the huge tube extending from her mouth. It looked like it was choking her, not helping her breathe. They've done a CT scan and there's no sign of swelling or brain injury. Everything looks fine, said Clementine. Swelling or brain injury. She tried to make the medical words feel meaningless, like a foreign language, just sounds coming out of her mouth, because she couldn't risk letting herself feel their full significance. They've done a chest X-ray and there is some fluid in the lungs, but that's to be expected. They're not too concerned. They've started her on a course of antibiotics. Her ribs are okay, no fractures.
Why wouldn't her ribs be okay? Asked her father.
Clementine cursed herself. She was trying to tell them anything positive she could, but there was no need to tell them all the things that could have gone wrong, but didn't. Or sometimes the force of the compressions, the CPR, but it's fine. It didn't. She heard Oliver counting out loud, and for a moment she couldn't speak. In the morning they'll reduce the medication, wake her up, and get her breathing on her own.
Can we see her? Said Clementine's mother.
I don't know, said Clementine. I'll ask. She shouldn't have let them come to the hospital. It would have been more sensible to tell them to wait at home, better for their elderly hearts. She hadn't thought. She just expected them to come, as though she was still a child and she needed the grown-ups. Once, she and Sam had been out at dinner with Erica and Oliver, and they'd got into a conversation about whether they felt like grown-ups. She and Sam had said they didn't. Not really. Erica and Oliver had looked perplexed and kind of appalled.
Of course I feel like a grown-up, said Erica. I'm free. I'm in charge.
Oliver had said, I couldn't wait to be a grown-up.
So then, said Clementine's mother, breathing heavily, was she having a heart attack?
Suddenly, she lunged at Clementine.
Why weren't you watching her?
She was so close, Clementine could smell the spicy scent on her breath of whatever she'd been eating for dinner.
You shouldn't have taken your eyes off her, not for a single second, not around water, for God's sake.
Pam, said Clementine's father. He went to take his wife's arm, and she shook it off. A young pregnant woman squeezed her way past them and stared curiously.
You're smarter than that. You know better, continued Pam, her eyes fixed on Clementine with such intensity it was as though Clementine were a stranger to her,
as though she were trying to work out who this person was who had harmed her granddaughter.
Were you drunk? How could you? How could you be so stupid?
Her face crumpled into a million lines before she covered it with both hands. Clementine hadn't even told her yet that it was Erica who had saved Ruby. Erica, the better daughter, the grateful daughter, the daughter who would never have made a mistake like this. Clementine's father put his arm around his wife. It's okay, he mouthed over her head. He led her up the walkway. Let's go and sit down. It's the shock, said Sam's mother, Joy. She was a woman who never left the house without her face, but tonight it was bare of makeup. Clementine had never seen her without lipstick before. Maybe no one had. It looked like her lips were missing. She must have been having her nightly read in the bath when she got the call. Clementine imagined her panic.
the throwing on of clothes before she was even properly dry. "Come on, darling," said Joy. "Chin up." Clementine could barely stand for shame. Chapter 62. The morning after the barbecue. "Clementine?" "What?" She must have dozed off. She didn't think she'd closed her eyes all night, but Sam was leaning over her, shaking her shoulder where she sat in the green leather chair next to Ruby's bed. There were purple shadows under Sam's red-rimmed eyes, black stubble along his jaw, and a thin line of white spittle around his lips. He had refused to sit at all. "Darl, you're not helping your daughter by standing for the whole night," the nurse had told him. But Sam seemed psychopathically determined to stand, as if Ruby's life depended on it, as if he were guarding her from harm. And eventually the nurse gave up, although every now and then she shot Sam a look as if she were just itching to stick a needle in his arm and knock him out. The nurse's name was Kylie. She was a New Zealander, and she spoke slowly and simply to them, saying everything twice, as if English were their second language. Probably all parents were dull-witted with shock. Kylie explained that in intensive care, every patient got their own nurse. "I've only got one job tonight, and that's Ruby." She told them there was a room available on the same floor where they could sleep, and she gave them little toiletry bags with toothbrushes and combs, of the style you might receive on an overnight premium economy flight. She advised them to try to get some sleep because Ruby was sedated and she wasn't going to know if they were there or not. But they'd already let Ruby down once. They weren't leaving her again. Sam spent the night watching Ruby and the screens monitoring Ruby's heart rhythm, her temperature, her breathing rate, and her oxygen levels, as if he knew what they meant, and indeed he had asked Kylie to explain. So maybe he really did understand. Clementine hadn't listened to the explanations. She spent the night with her eyes travelling back and forth between Ruby and Kylie's face. She felt that Kylie's face would tell her if there was anything to be concerned about, although she was wrong, because during the night, Ruby's oxygen levels dropped, and Kylie's face remained exactly the same while the doctor on duty was called, and Sam moved quietly to the corner of the room with a clenched fist pressed hard against his cheek, as if he were poised to knock himself out. Ruby's oxygen levels went back up to an acceptable level again, but the adrenaline buzzed through Clementine for the next few hours. It was a reminder that they could not, should not relax, even for a moment. "The doctor is here," said Sam now, as Clementine rubbed her eyes and swallowed, her mouth dry and sour. "They're going to extubate. Wake her up." "Good morning," said a pale-haired, pale-skinned doctor. "Let's see if we can wake up this little sleeping beauty, shall we?" It was fast. The tubes came out. The mask was removed. After 20 minutes, Ruby frowned heavily. Her eyelids twitched. "Ruby?" said Sam, as if he were begging for his life. Ruby's eyes finally fluttered open. She stared at the cannula in her arm with an expression of pure disgust. Thankfully, her thumb-sucking hand was free, and she jammed her thumb in her mouth. She looked up, found her parents, and looked angrier still.
"Whisk!"
she demanded hoarsely. The relief Clementine experienced as she rushed to deliver Whisk was exquisite, glorious, like the cessation of an agonizing pain, like a gasp of air when you'd been forced to hold your breath.
She looked for Sam with the vague expectation that something would now happen between them, something important and climactic. They would grab hands, for example. Their fingers would lock together in mutual joy, and they would smile down at Ruby while tears rained down their faces. But it didn't happen. They looked at each other, and yes, they did smile, and yes, their eyes were full of tears. But something wasn't quite right. She didn't know who looked away first. She didn't know if it was her coldness or his coldness, if she was blaming him or he was blaming her. But then Ruby began to cry, distressed by her sore throat from the tube, and the doctor started talking, and it was all too late. It was another moment they'd never get back to do right. Chapter 63. Dinner is ready, called Sam, and he sounded perfectly normal, not at all like the stranger who, less than 1 hour ago, had discussed separating. I think I'm done with us. Now he sounded just like Daddy, like Sam, like himself. The smell of Sam's signature dish, shepherd's pie, filled the house. Clementine loved his shepherd's pie, but the girls hated it, which was annoying because it seemed like the sort of nutritious, kid-friendly food they should like. So every week they kept deluding themselves and trying again.
When will it ever stop raining? Asked Holly as she turned off her iPad with all the technological insouciance of a millennium kid. It is actually driving me crazy.
Me too, said Clementine. Ruby, come on, dinner time.
Ruby looked up from where she was sitting in the middle of a circle of dolls and plush toys. She had placed them around her in imitation of story circle at daycare and had been pretending to read them a Curious George book, holding it up in the same way that her teacher obviously did at daycare, and carefully licking her finger each time she turned the page.
It's nap time, said Ruby cheerfully, and knocked the toys into sleeping positions with a casual backhand.
Hopefully she hadn't learned that at daycare too.
What's for dinner?
Holly ran to the table and sat herself up. She grabbed her knife and fork with ominous enthusiasm.
Pasta? It's pasta, right?
It's shepherd's pie, said Sam, as Clementine strapped Ruby into the big girl booster seat she now used instead of a high chair.
What?
Holly slumped, as if to news of a great injustice.
Shepherd's pie? Again? We had it last night?
You did not have it last night, said Sam evenly, putting the plate in front of her. You had pasta with Grandma last night while Mummy and Daddy went out to dinner.
There's some still in the fridge, said Holly excitedly. I remember we didn't eat it all, and Grandma said that...
There's none left in the fridge, said Clementine. I ate it last night.
What?
Cried Holly. Life was a series of travesties.
But you went to a restaurant.
It wasn't a very good restaurant, so we came home early, said Clementine. Mummy and Daddy can no longer stand to go out to dinner together. Mummy and Daddy no longer like each other very much. Mummy and Daddy might be separating.
What?
Sit up straight, Holly, said Clementine mechanically. Holly squawked. Please don't make that sound, said Clementine. Please? Holly made the sound again, but softer.
Holly! Yuck, said Ruby.
She picked up her spoon and held it limply between her fingertips over the plate. She let it swing back and forth.
No, thank you.
I'll give you no thank you, said Sam. Come on, girls, just a little bit.
Mmm, delicious, said Clementine, taking a mouthful. Good work, Daddy.
Well, I'm not eating any of it, said Holly. She folded her arms and pressed her lips together. I have too many taste buds.
What do you mean you have too many taste buds? Said Sam, as he determinedly shoveled food into his own mouth.
Kids have more taste buds than grown-ups. That's why it tastes yucky, said Holly.
She saw it on that TV show, said Clementine. Remember? The one with the, I don't care how many taste buds you've got, said Sam. You can try a mouthful.
Bleh,
said Holly. Let's see some good manners, said Clementine. Sam didn't look at her. It was as though he'd just been waiting all these years for the perfect excuse to hate her, and finally he'd gotten it. Her throat filled. The shepherd's pie wasn't as good as it normally was. Too heavy on the Worcestershire sauce. She put down her fork and had a mouthful of water.
I've got a sore tummy, moaned Holly.
No, you don't, said Clementine. Clementine's mother thought their marriage was a problem that could be fixed with a good dose of common sense and elbow grease. Marriages were hard work. But what could they say to a counsellor? They weren't fighting over money or sex or housework. There were no knotty issues to untangle. Everything was the same as before the barbecue. It's just that nothing felt the same. She looked at Ruby, who sat in front of her in perfect, pink-cheeked, giggling, naughty health, and remembered how strange it had felt when Ruby was transferred out of the hushed, important environment of ICU and into an ordinary ward with ordinary patients and busy, distracted nurses. No lovely Kylie just for them. It was like going from a five-star hotel to a youth hostel. Then, after two nights in the ordinary ward, an extraordinarily young, tired doctor flipped through Ruby's paperwork and said, "You should be able to take her home tomorrow." Her chest was clear. She hadn't needed physio. The antibiotics had successfully fought off the chest infection before it took hold of her. Of course, there would be neurological checkups, outpatient care. She'd be monitored. But she was fine. First world medical care meant they didn't have to pay for their first world negligence. They'd brought her home to a stack of presents and an overly loving big sister who at intervals would try to pick her up and cuddle her, something she'd never done much of before, and would inevitably squeeze too hard and Ruby would shriek and Holly would get yelled at. No one behaved normally except for Ruby, who clearly wanted the fuss over. She did not want to sleep in the big bed with either of her parents. She wanted her own cot, and she did not want a parent sleeping on the floor of her bedroom. She would stagger to her feet on the cot, her thumb in her mouth, and point whisk at the offending parent.
"Go away," she would say.
So they went. Ruby seemed to sense if anyone became too clingy or sappy. Clementine sometimes sat holding her, quietly crying, and if Ruby noticed, she would look up angrily and say, "Stop that!" She did not want to be cherished, thank you very much, unless it involved an extra biscuit. They should have been like lottery winners. They'd got a reprieve, a last-minute pardon. They were allowed to return to their ordinary lives and their ordinary worries. Two arguments over shepherd's pie. So why were they not living their lives in a permanent state of joy and relief?
I am not going to eat one single bit of this, said Holly.
She folded her arms dramatically.
Not one single bit.
Well, in that case, I'm not going to let you have one single minute on my iPad, said Sam. Not one single minute.
What? Cried Holly,
predictably shocked and enraged, as if this were a brand new threat, not one she heard virtually every day of her life.
No fair!
Just one mouthful, said Sam to Holly. You too, Ruby.
Did you play with Isabel at Honeybees today? Said Clementine to Ruby.
Yes, said Ruby.
She lifted her eyes and tapped her fingers to her mouth, trying to remember.
I mean, no.
They said she was fine at daycare. Not traumatized or affected in any way as far as they could see, just happy to be back. In that first month after the accident, Clementine had decided, and she truly meant it at the time, that she would give up her career and become a stay-at-home mother. She had even allowed for the fact that they wouldn't be able to afford the mortgage repayments. They would sell the house, sell the cello, and rent a modest flat, where Clementine would spend her days grating vegetables, doing craft, and never removing her eyes from her children. She had said to Ruby, "Would you like to give up Honeybees and stay at home with Mummy every day?" Ruby had looked at her as if she'd asked for a treat and been offered a raw carrot.
"No, thank you,"
she enunciated very clearly. So that was the end of that, as a means of atonement.
"Fine then, I'll have one mouthful."
Holly picked up her fork and took the teeniest, tiniest possible mouthful. Her face contorted into a paroxysm of disgust.
"Oh, for God's sake!"
Sam thumped the palm of his hand flat on the tabletop so hard all their plates rattled and everyone jumped. He stood, grabbed both the girls' plates and walked into the kitchen, where he dropped them into the sink with a loud clatter. There was silence. Holly and Ruby looked flabbergasted. This was never part of the shepherd's pie routine. It wasn't meant to be serious. They weren't a family who yelled and thumped tables. Ruby's lip trembled. Her eyes swam with tears. "It's okay, Ruby," said Clementine. Ruby ducked her head and covered her face with her hands as if she were trying to hide.
"Oh, God, Ruby, I'm so sorry, sweetheart," said Sam from the kitchen.
He sounded close to tears.
"I just got frustrated. I'm very sorry. Very, very sorry."
Ruby lifted her tear-stained face and sucked noisily and deliberately on her thumb.
"That was actually a very loud voice, Daddy," said Holly shakily. "It hurt my ears."
"I know. I'm sorry."
"Who wants ice cream?" said Sam.
"Lots of ice cream."
"What? They can't have ice cream for dinner."
Clementine, whose chair faced away from the kitchen, turned around to look at him.
"Sure they can," said Sam feverishly.
"Why not?"
He went to the freezer.
"They should at least have a bread roll first," said Clementine. "I want ice cream,"
howled Ruby, suddenly recovered and furious, waving her pink, waterlogged thumb in the air for emphasis.
"Me too," said Holly.
"Bloody hell, Sam," said Clementine. "They're not having ice cream for dinner." Their parenting these days was all over the place. They veered from excessive leniency to excessive strictness and back again.
"They're having ice cream," said Sam.
He put the tub of ice cream on the bench and pulled off the lid. He was frenzied, agitated. It was like he was on drugs.
"Who cares if they have ice cream for dinner? Seize the day. Live for the moment. Life is short. Dance like no one is watching, or whatever that crap is."
Clementine stared at him. "Why are you being so..."
"Where's the ice cream scoop?" said Sam,
his head down as he looked through the cutlery drawer.
"The one with the polar bear... It's lost!"
shouted Clementine.
"Like everything else."
Chapter 64. The morning after the barbecue.
Dakota felt her unhappiness before she opened her eyes. It was like her whole body felt different, flatter, heavier and yet emptier, as if something had been sucked out of her. Yesterday, she had done something terrible, disgusting, and irresponsible. She had played with a beautiful little girl like she was a doll, and then she'd just tossed her aside when she'd got bored with her and gone to play with something else, and the little girl had nearly drowned. She thought about the lady on the corner who was having a baby. Dakota and her mum had run into her at the shops just last week, and Dakota's mum had suggested that Dakota could babysit one day when she was older, and the lady had been all, "That would be great." And everyone had been all smiley, not knowing that Dakota was so irresponsible she could never ever be a babysitter. She would let the baby electrocute itself, or get burned by an iron, or pull a saucepan of hot, bubbling soup over itself, or bang! Dakota jumped. There was an awful banging, crashing, smashing sound coming from the backyard. She threw off her covers and ran to her bedroom window. She got up on her knees on the window seat and pulled back the blind. Her dad was standing in the fountain, except all the water was gone, so there was nothing but ugly, muddy ground. He was swinging a big metal bar like a baseball bat at the giant monument in the middle of the fountain. Dakota was reminded of some old footage she'd seen on TV once from a war or a revolution or something, where hundreds of people were using ropes to pull down a giant statue of a man, and they all cheered as it slowly toppled. Except in this case, it was just one person, her dad. And she'd never seen him look or act like this, angry and silent and violent, as if he wanted to kill someone or something. She watched the marble head of an angel baby go flying through the air, and then she couldn't stand to watch anymore. She ran back to her bed and hid under the covers like a little kid trying to hide from a thunderstorm. Chapter 65. "Where are we going, Mum?" said Dakota for the third time from the back of the car.
"Maybe that new Japanese restaurant I was telling you about this morning," said Vid hopefully from the passenger seat. "That's over this way, isn't it? Best tempura in Sydney, apparently. Did you make a reservation?"
"I bet you made a reservation, eh? As a surprise."
"We're not going to a restaurant," said Tiffany, as she drove through a roundabout, keeping an eye out for road signs. She knew exactly where she was going because she'd renovated a few properties around here. She'd done nicely with them too. It was so easy to give the hipsters what they wanted. Their little hipster hearts reliably exploded over an original-looking decorative ceiling. "We're just going to make a quick visit," said Tiffany. "We're going to just drop by."
"People don't really do that anymore," said Vid gloomily. He'd love it if people still dropped by.
He sighed.
"You know, if we're going where I think we're going, it's not a good idea." "Are we going where I think we're going?"
"Yep," said Tiffany. She glanced at him, and he shrugged. He avoided confrontation. He just wanted everyone to be happy. The conflicted expression on Vid's face at a wake — he had a big extended family, people died regularly — was always priceless. "I'm not allowed to look happy, even though I'm at a party with all these great people." "Where are we going, Dad?" Dakota leaned forward and pushed her face in between the two seats.
"We're going out to dinner." Vid pulled out his phone. "I'm going to make us a reservation right now."
This is it, said Tiffany triumphantly. She drove slowly down a narrow, car-lined street. That was the problem with these cool inner-city locations. It was all very funky, but you could never get a freaking parking spot.
You'll never get a park, said Vid to her.
He had his phone to his ear.
Forget it. It's not a good idea. Yes? Hello? I hear you have the best tempura in Sydney. Is that right? It is right. Great. Well, can we try some tonight? No, come on now. Are you sure you can't squeeze us in a corner somewhere? We are only three small people.
Where are we? Said Dakota. We're going to drop by at Clementine and Sam's place, said Tiffany with cheery bravado. The earlier conviction she'd felt suddenly wavered. She had their address only because Erica had given it to her so they could send Ruby a get-well present, for which they'd received a polite but standoffish thank-you card by return mail. The thank-you card had made it clear, "We don't want to see you ever again."
What? Said Dakota. Why?
Is that a spot? Can I do it? Said Tiffany as she reverse parked the Lexus in between two hybrids. Of course I can do it. I am the champion. Got us a reservation. Vid waved his mobile triumphantly. He looked around.
So, you found a spot.
I'll just go knock on the door, said Tiffany. Make sure they're home.
Yeah, we'll stay here, said Vid. You check if they're in the mood.
Do they know we're coming? Said Dakota.
No, said Tiffany. It's a surprise visit. I'll tell them we were in the area.
Vid snorted. Tiffany got out of the car, popped her umbrella open, and slung her bag over her shoulder. She'd put one of Vid's strudels from the freezer into her bag before they left. She stopped. The rain fell softly in a resigned, bored fashion, like it was sick of itself too. Tiffany paused. Was this the right thing to do? Eventually they would all forget, move on with their lives.
Mum?
Tiffany turned. Dakota had wound down her window and was poking her head out. She looked flushed and breathless.
If Holly and Ruby are there, and if they, like, do want to see me, I'll, like, come inside.
Me too, Vid leaned over the seat. I'll, come inside too.
It was the right thing to do. She drew herself upright and walked toward the house. She thought, randomly, of the night she'd auditioned for the job at the club. The terror of walking that catwalk in those high-platform shoes. She remembered telling Clementine about it. Yeah, it really compared to an audition for the Sydney Royal Chamber Orchestra. But Clementine had needed distraction. So Tiffany just told her whatever crap came into her head. And afterwards, she'd felt embarrassed, as if she'd made Clementine listen to sleazy, sordid stories from her past. Number 9 was a cute, charming, narrow little two-story sandstone house. It was jammed in between two other almost identical-looking terraces. Tiffany studied them and wondered whether they were heritage-listed. She imagined a demolition ball smashing through all that charmingness and a three-level apartment block going up in its place. Wrong. Oh, so very wrong and evil. But oh, so profitable. As she rapped the lion's head door knocker, she wondered if she might hear cello music. But instead, she heard a man's voice shouting, Sam? Surely not. He was too genial. Now she could hear a woman yelling,
Oh, geez, Louise. Great timing. She'd dropped by when they were in the middle of a fight. She turned indecisively back toward the street. Mission abort? Go eat Sydney's best freaking tempura. The door swung open. It was Holly. She wore a blue and white checked school uniform, long fluffy purple socks, and strands of coloured beads around her neck.
Hello. Tiffany smiled. Remember me?
You're Dakota's mum, said Holly. I'm going to invite Dakota to my birthday party. My daddy said she wouldn't want to come.
I think she'd love to come, said Tiffany.
Holly got a look of pure vindication on her face. She turned on her heel and ran. Dad!
Tiffany! Clementine appeared in the hallway. She looked aghast.
Hi. I didn't even hear the knock on the door. How are you?
I'm fine, said Tiffany.
Clementine looked thinner than when Tiffany had seen her last, and drabber, older.
We're going out to dinner, said Tiffany, and I knew you lived nearby, so I thought I'd drop off some of Vid's strudel. I remember you liked it.
Dakota and Vid are in the car.
She took the container with the frozen strudel from her handbag and handed it over to Clementine, who took it warily, as if it were radioactive.
Thank you, she said, and thank you again for the lovely doll you sent for Ruby.
You're welcome, said Tiffany. We got your thank you card. I think Vid has been trying to call you.
Clementine winced. I'm sorry, yes, I know. I've been meaning to give you a call. It's just that you don't really want to have any contact with us because you don't want to think about that day and because you didn't really know us that well in the first place, said Tiffany. She was sick of the bullshit.
I get it. I do get it.
Clementine flinched. But the thing is, Dakota blames herself for what happened to Ruby that day. She's been making herself sick with guilt over it.
Clementine's mouth dropped. She looked like she might cry.
Really? Seriously? I'm so sorry. I'll talk to her. I'll tell her it was nothing to do with her.
Dakota needs to see Ruby, said Tiffany. She needs to see she's okay. And actually, I think Vid needs to see her too. Just for a minute. I know we don't know your family that well, but it happened at our home. And you've got to realize this affected us too. And she stopped because Ruby had suddenly come running down the hallway carrying her whisk. When she saw the unexpected guest at the front door, she wrapped her arm around her mother's leg, put her thumb in her mouth, and considered Tiffany.
Hello, Ruby.
Tiffany squatted down to Ruby's height and put the back of her hand on her pink, velvety cheek. Ruby gazed back at her with big, blue, disinterested eyes. Some random grown-up who didn't appear to be carrying gifts. Tiffany smiled up at Clementine. It turned out that she'd needed to see Ruby too.
She looks great, she said.
Clementine pushed open the front door a little wider.
Why don't you go and get Vid and Dakota, she said.
Chapter 66. Another rainy morning. Another talk to a group of elderly people. Clementine's eyes felt hot and dry as she drove into the car park of the community hall where the Hills District Retirees Association held their monthly meeting. She'd been up most of the night with the word separate going round and round in her head until finally she'd sat up, found a notepad and a pen, and wrote in it,
Because wasn't there some research that suggested the act of writing down your worries reduced stress? In fact, it was shocking to see it written down so boldly like that. It hadn't helped her stress levels at all. She had torn out the sheet of paper and ripped it up into tiny pieces. When Vid, Tiffany, and Dakota had left last night after their unexpected visit, Clementine had felt almost cheerful. There had been a definite sense of relief. The slip-sliding feeling of release after a fearfully anticipated event had finally taken place. The idea of seeing Vid and Tiffany had been so much more traumatic than the reality. All their qualities had become exaggerated in her memories of that night, when in fact they were just ordinary, friendly people. Tiffany wasn't quite as sexy as Clementine remembered. Vid wasn't quite as charismatic. They didn't have special hypnotic sexual powers. And poor little Dakota was just a kid who had been carrying around a terrible burden of guilt that had not been hers to bear. But it was immediately clear that Sam didn't feel the same way. As soon as they'd left, he turned on his heel and gone straight into the kitchen to pack the dishwasher. He'd refused to talk about anything except the ongoing administration of their lives. He was taking Holly for her taekwondo class before school. She would transfer some money onto the credit card. They didn't need to worry about dinner tomorrow night because they were going to Clementine's parents' house. Then off they'd gone to their separate beds. It had occurred to her during the long night that she and Sam already were separated. People could legally separate and live under the same roof. That's exactly what they were doing. It was a relief when her alarm had gone off and she could give up trying to sleep. She'd got up and done her audition practice, and then she'd had an early morning lesson with 13-year-old Logan, who she'd been teaching for the past 2 years and who didn't want to be there, but smiled so politely at her, as if he did. Logan's music teacher had told his mother that he had talent and that it would be a crime not to foster it. Logan was technically proficient, but his heart was with the electric guitar. That was his passion. As Logan had played that morning, dutifully following every one of Clementine's instructions, she'd found herself wondering if that was how she sounded to Ainsley when she practiced her audition pieces. What was that awful word she'd used? Robotic. Should she tell poor little Logan he sounded robotic? But what would be the point? She bet he didn't sound robotic on his electric guitar. Now it was only 11:30, and she felt like she'd been up for hours. Because she had, in fact, been up for hours, she reminded herself as she put up her umbrella to walk through the crowded car park.
"Where's your violin, dear?"
asked the head of the Hills District Retirees Association when Clementine introduced herself. "My violin," said Clementine. "I'm actually a cellist, but,
"Your cello, then,"
said the woman, with a little roll of her eyes to indicate Clementine's unnecessary attention to petty detail. A cello was just a big violin, after all.
"Where's your cello, dear?"
"But I'm not playing the cello," said Clementine uneasily. "I'm a guest speaker. I'm doing a talk." She had a moment of sudden terror. She was doing a talk, wasn't she? This wasn't a gig. Of course it wasn't. She was doing a talk.
"Oh, are you?"
said the woman, disappointedly. She studied the piece of paper in her hand.
"It says here you're a cellist. We thought you'd be playing for us."
She looked at Clementine expectantly, as if a solution might present itself. Clementine lifted her hands. "I'm sorry," she said. "I'm doing a talk. It's called One Ordinary Day." For God's sake. She felt exhausted. Was there really any point to all this? Was she actually helping, or was she just doing it to make herself feel better? To pay her penance, her dues, to even things up on the universal scale of right and wrong? The community talks had all come about because she'd been trying to redeem herself in her mother's eyes. A few days after they'd brought Ruby home from hospital, Clementine had been having a cup of tea with her mother, and she'd said, she could still hear the reedy, self-conscious tone with which she'd spoken, that she felt she should do something to raise awareness of how easily an accident like this could happen and make sure no one else made the same mistake she had made. She felt she should tell her story. She'd meant she should write one of those touching, please share Facebook posts that would go viral. She probably would never have gotten around to doing even that. But her mother had been thrilled. What a wonderful idea! Clementine could do talks to community groups, mothers' groups, associations. They were always looking for guest speakers. She could partner with a first aid course provider, like St. John Ambulance, hand out leaflets at the end, maybe offering a discount on a course. Pam would set it all up. She had all the contacts. She had a wide circle of friends who belonged to caring community groups across Sydney. They were always desperate for guest speakers. She'd be like Clementine's agent. "This could save lives, Clementine," Pam had said, with that familiar evangelical look in her eyes. Oh, God, Clementine had thought. But it was too late. As her father would say, "The Pam train has left the station. Nothing can stop it now." She did feel it was the right thing to do. It's just that it was hard to fit the talks into an already crammed life, especially when she was driving all over Sydney to do them in between gigs and teaching and school pickups and audition practice. And then there was the fact that she had to relive the worst, most shameful day of her life. "This is a story that begins with a barbecue," she said today, to the members of the Hills District Retirees Association who were eating lamb with gravy and roast potatoes and peas for lunch as she spoke. An ordinary neighbourhood barbecue in an ordinary backyard. "You need to make it a story," her mother had told her. "A story has power." "We can't hear you," called out someone from the back of the room. "Can you hear her? I can't hear a word she's saying." Clementine leaned in closer to the microphone. She heard someone at the table nearest the lectern say, "I thought we had a violinist coming today." Beads of sweat ran all the way down her back. She kept talking. She told her story as cutlery scraped against plates. She gave them facts and figures. A child can be submerged in 10 seconds, lose consciousness in 2 minutes, and sustain permanent brain damage in 4 to 6 minutes. 9 out of 10 children who have died in the water were being watched by adults. A child can drown in as little as 5 centimetres of water. She talked about the importance of first aid training and how 30,000 Australians died of cardiac arrest every year because there was no one around with the basic CPR knowledge to save their lives. She talked about the wonderful work that CareFlight did and how they were always grateful for donations. When she'd finished, the president of the association gave her a box of chocolates and asked her fellow members to join her in a round of applause for their very interesting guest speaker today. Very informative, and thank goodness her daughter was all recovered and maybe next time Clementine could come and play her cello for them. Afterwards, as she was heading for the door, her dress damp against her back, a man approached her, wiping his mouth with his napkin. She steeled herself. Sometimes people couldn't resist coming up afterwards to tell her off, to inform her that she should never have taken her eyes off her toddler. But as soon as she saw the man's face, she knew he wasn't one of those. He was the other sort. He had the relaxed authority of someone who had once been the boss, but the bruised eyes of someone who had suffered a devastating loss. It was a look around the eyes, like fruit that has gone soft and is close to rotting. He had a story he needed to share. It was her job to listen. This was her real penance. He would probably cry. The women didn't cry. Elderly women were as tough as nails, but it seemed that men got softer as they aged. Their emotions caught them off guard, as if some protective barrier had been worn away by time. She braced herself. "My grandson would have been 32 this weekend," he said. "Ah," said Clementine. She waited for the story. There was always a chain of events that had to be explained. If this hadn't happened, if this had happened. In this case, it had all started with a broken phone. His daughter's downstairs phone was broken, so she ran upstairs to answer it. And at that moment, the next-door neighbour knocked on the front door and got talking to his son-in-law, and in the meantime, the little fella got outside. He dragged a chair over to the pool gate. There was a tennis ball floating in the pool. He was trying to get to the ball. He liked playing cricket. Was pretty good at it, too. He was a little pocket rocket. Couldn't sit still. You wouldn't have thought he'd be big enough to drag that chair, but he did it. Determined. "I'm so sorry," said Clementine. "Well, I just wanted to tell you that you are doing a good thing," said the man. He hadn't cried, thank God. "Raising awareness. It's a good thing. Makes people think twice. Families don't get over it when something like this happens. My daughter's marriage broke up. My wife was never the same again. She was the one on the phone, you see. Never forgave herself for ringing at that time. Not her fault, of course, or the neighbour's fault. Just bad luck. Bad timing. But there you go. Accidents happen. Anyhow, you did a good job today, pet. Spoke very well." "Thank you," said Clementine. "You sure you don't want to stay and join us for dessert? They do a very tasty pavlova here." "That's nice of you," said Clementine. "But I have to go." "No worries. Off you go. I'm sure you're busy," said the man. He patted her on the arm. She headed toward the door, released. "Tom," he said suddenly. She turned back, steeled herself. Here it came. His eyes filled with tears, overflowed. "The little fella's name. In case you wondered. His name was Tom." All the way home, she cried. For the little fella, for the grandmother who'd made the phone call, for the grandfather who'd shared his story, and for the parents, because their marriage hadn't survived, and because it seemed like Clementine's marriage wasn't going to survive either. Chapter 67. It was early Thursday evening when Tiffany walked into the living area and saw Dakota sitting cross-legged on the window seat. She was reading a book in a little circle of lamplight, the blue, fluffy blanket over her legs, while raindrops slid down the window behind her. Barney was curled up in her lap. Dakota was absent-mindedly caressing one of his ears as she read. Tiffany caught herself just in time from exclaiming, "You're reading," and said instead, "You're there." Dakota looked up from her book quizzically. "I didn't know where you were," said Tiffany. "I'm here,"
said Dakota. Her eyes returned to her book.
Yes, you are.
Tiffany backed away. Yes, you are definitely here. There. She found Vid sitting at the kitchen table with his laptop, watching a masterclass on making the perfect tempura batter. He was officially obsessed after last night's dinner, which had sent him into rhapsodies.
She's reading again,
whispered Tiffany, pointing over her shoulder. Vid gave a cursory thumbs up and kept looking at the screen.
You fry by sound, not by sight, he said. Interesting, eh? I have to listen.
He put his hand to his ear to demonstrate. Tiffany sat down next to him and watched the chef demonstrate how to gently stretch a shrimp. It was good we went last night, she said. Vid shrugged.
They were strange. They didn't say anything. Silent.
That's because you didn't give them a chance to speak, said Tiffany. When Vid got nervous, he talked. Last night, he hadn't appeared to draw breath for the entire 10-minute duration of their strange little visit. It was only the three children who had behaved normally. Holly and Ruby had been thrilled to see Dakota and had dragged her off to see bedrooms and toys and everything else in their house.
This is our fridge, Holly had said. This is our television. That's my mum's cello. Don't touch it. You're not allowed to touch it under any circumstance.
In the meantime, the four grown-ups had stood in a strange, awkward foursome in the living room. Sam avoided all eye contact with Tiffany, as if it were illegal to look at her. Everything about him seemed clenched.
They never even offered us a drink, said Vid.
He couldn't get over that. He'd be offering drinks during an earthquake. Yeah, well, said Tiffany, they didn't want us there.
Humph, said Vid. The little girl looks good. Very healthy. Rosy cheeks. We should have all been happy, celebrating.
I think they blame themselves, said Tiffany.
But she's fine. She's perfect. She's beautiful, said Vid robustly. Thanks to Erika and Oliver. All good. No need for the glam faces. Shh, now. I'm trying to concentrate on my tempura.
You're the one talking.
Tiffany flicked his neck with her fingertip as she stood up. He slapped her bum in return. She went to the sink to get herself a glass of water and stood watching Dakota read. She felt immensely pleased with herself, like she'd pulled off a difficult deal. Visiting Clementine and Sam had been exactly the right thing to do. Socially awkward, but absolutely the right thing for her family. Last night, while they'd been standing in the hallway about to leave, and Vid was talking on and on about spotted gum floorboards, Clementine had pulled Dakota aside, taken her hand, and placed it between her own in an almost ceremonial way, and said, "Your mum told me you felt bad about what happened to Ruby at your place. Dakota, I forbid you to feel bad for another minute, for another second, okay? It was my responsibility." Tiffany had expected Dakota to say nothing, to just nod dumbly. But to her surprise, Dakota had spoken up, clearly, although her eyes had stayed fixed on her trapped hand. "I should have told you I was going inside to read my book."
"But see, I knew you'd gone inside," said Clementine. "I knew the moment you went inside, because your mum told me. So that had nothing to do with anything. You weren't their babysitter. When you're older, you probably will do babysitting and you'll be very responsible. You'll be wonderful, in fact, I know it.
but my girls were not your responsibility that afternoon. So you must promise me you won't worry about this anymore, because...
Clementine's voice had momentarily wavered.
Because I just can't bear it if you feel bad about that day too. I honestly cannot bear it.
Tiffany saw Dakota stiffen, repelled by the level of raw, grown-up emotion in Clementine's voice. Clementine released her hand, and in that instant, you could almost see Dakota make a decision. A decision to accept absolution and be a kid again. And now she was back reading. Dakota had told Tiffany that she'd given up reading as a punishment to herself, because that was her most favourite thing in the world. "Were you going to give up reading forever?" Tiffany had asked her, and Dakota had shrugged. She had also admitted that she had destroyed her copy of The Hunger Games because that was the book she'd been reading when Ruby nearly drowned. Tiffany had considered telling her that she really shouldn't destroy her possessions. Books cost money, money didn't grow on trees, etc. But instead she said, "I'll buy you another copy." And at first, Dakota said quietly, "Oh, that's okay." But when Tiffany pushed, she said, "Thanks, Mum. That would be great, because it was actually an awesome book." Now Tiffany watched her turn the page, deep in her own world. To never once say a word about how she was really feeling for all those weeks while her secret guilt festered. Jesus, she'd have to watch that kid like a hawk. She was like Tiffany's sister Louise, who ran much too deep, as their mother said, while Tiffany presumably ran much too shallow. The doorbell rang. "I'll get it," said Tiffany unnecessarily, as it was clear neither Vid nor Dakota was moving. She felt a sense of déjà vu. Dakota lying on the window seat, the doorbell ringing. The morning of the barbecue. "Hi there. I'm..." The man on the doorstep stopped. His gaze travelled a straight line down Tiffany's body. She wore yoga pants and an old T-shirt, but the man was looking at her like she was wearing her schoolgirl outfit from her dancing days. Tiffany jutted one hip and waited it out. Enjoyed it, to be frank. She was in a good mood. His eyes returned to her face. "That'll be $10, buddy." "Hello," said the man, clearing his throat. He was in his late 20s, very fair, and he was blushing. It was adorable. "Okay, you can have it for free." "Hi," said Tiffany huskily, making eye contact just to see if she could make him blush more, which, yes, it seemed she could. The poor man was crimson now. "I'm Steve." He held out his hand. "Steve Lunt." He was a little posh, one of those carefully enunciated voices you felt compelled to imitate. "My uncle, my great uncle, Harry Lunt, lived next door." "Oh, right." Tiffany straightened as she shook his hand. "Shit. Hello. I'm Tiffany. We're very sorry about your uncle." "Well, thank you, but I actually only met him once, as a child," said Steve. "And to be honest, he scared the life out of me." "I didn't know he had family," said Tiffany. "We're all in Adelaide," said Steve. His colour had returned to normal now. "And, as I'm sure you're aware, Harry wasn't exactly sociable." "Well," said Tiffany, "we were Harry's only relatives, and my mother did her best, but it was really just the odd Christmas card and phone call. Poor Mum would sit there, while he bellowed abuse at her. We, all the neighbours, we felt terrible that it took so many weeks before we realised. Tiffany stopped.
I understand you found his body, said Steve.
Must have been upsetting.
Yes, said Tiffany, it was.
She remembered throwing up into the sandstone pot. What had happened to that pot? Would this poor man be responsible for it? I feel bad that we didn't keep more of an eye on him.
I doubt he would have welcomed anyone keeping an eye on him, said Steve.
If it makes you feel better, he apparently told my mother you were nice.
He said we were nice?
Tiffany was astounded.
Steve smiled. I think the exact words he actually used were nice enough.
Anyhow, I just wanted to let you know that we'll be doing a bit of work on the place before we put it on the market. Hopefully there won't be too much noise or disruption.
Thanks, said Tiffany. She did a rough calculation on the value of Harry's place. Maybe she should make an offer.
I'm sure it'll be fine. We're early risers.
Right. Well, good to meet you.
Better get back to it.
Tiffany closed the door and thought of Harry's vulnerable bent back as he'd shuffled across the lawn to his own place. She remembered the fury in his eyes when he'd shouted at her, "Are you stupid?" It was interesting that fury and fear could look so much the same.
Chapter 68. So it looks like Mum is not going to cancel, said Erica. She'd been waiting all day for a phone call from her mother saying that she had a headache, or she didn't feel up to it, or it was too rainy, or, outrageously, that she was catching up on a bit of housework, so she wouldn't be able to join them at Clementine's parents' house for dinner after all. But the phone call hadn't come. In a minute, they'd be picking Sylvia up and discovering what personality she'd selected for the evening. Sylvia often went for a dreamy, bohemian persona when she was seeing Clementine's parents, as if she were an artist of some sort, and they were the stuffy suburban couple who had stepped in to help take care of her daughter when she was distracted doing her art. Another popular option was jaded alcoholic sex kitten, channeling Elizabeth Taylor. Except Sylvia didn't drink. She'd just hold her glass of water with careless elegance, as if it were a martini, and speak in a low, husky voice. Whichever personality she chose, the point was to make it clear that she was somehow special and different, and there was therefore no need to feel guilty or especially grateful for how much time Erica had spent at Clementine's home as a child.
Oh well, said Oliver.
He was in a great mood. Clementine had filled in all the interim paperwork, she'd been for a blood test, and she'd made an appointment to see the counsellor at the IVF clinic. Things were progressing. Each time Clementine passed him something across the table tonight, he'd probably be checking out her bone structure and imagining his super-efficient sperm, tests indicated perfect motility, zipping about the petri dish with her eggs. Clementine's parents can handle her. Erica's phone beeped just as Oliver turned into her mother's street and her heart lifted.
11th hour reprieve, she crowed.
But it was her mother saying to let her know when they were close so that she could be waiting out front. Erica texted back, on approach right now. Her mother texted back, great! Exclamation mark, exclamation mark, kiss, kiss. Good God, double exclamation marks and kisses? What could that mean?
Looks like the neighbours have got their for sale sign up already, said Oliver as he parked the car.
Wow, he said.
She's outdone herself.
Told you so, said Erica.
Erica's mother's front yard looked as it had on her previous visit.
Maybe worse. She couldn't remember. I think we need to call in the professionals, said Oliver, his eyes on the yard. Take her out somewhere, do it while she's gone.
She won't fall for that again, said Erica. She'd taken her mother away for the weekend once and sent in cleaners, returning her mother to an unrecognizable, beautiful home. When they'd got back, her mother had slapped Erica across the face and refused to speak to her for 6 months because of her betrayal. Erica had known she was betraying her. She'd felt like Judas that whole weekend.
We'll work it out.
Here she comes. She looks...
Gosh, she looks great.
Oliver jumped out of the car in the rain to open the back door for Sylvia, who carried a large white wooden-handled umbrella and wore a beautiful tailored cream suit, like something Jane Fonda would wear to accept a Lifetime Achievement Award. Her hair was bouncy and shiny. She must have been to the hairdresser. And as she got in the car, all Erica could smell was perfume. Nothing damp or moldy or rotting. It was a trick. The ultimate trick. Tonight, they weren't going to pretend that there was a reason why Clementine's parents had virtually adopted Erica. Tonight, they were going to pretend it had never happened at all. And of course, they would all go along with it and let her get away with it. They'd all behave as if Sylvia lived in a home that matched that beautiful brand new outfit.
Hello, darling,
said her mother in a breathless, feminine, I'm a lovely mother voice. You look nice, said Erica.
Do I?
Thank you, said her mother. I called Pam earlier to ask if I could bring anything, and she absolutely insisted I come empty-handed. She said something very mysterious about how the evening was in honour of you and Oliver, although she knows you both don't like to talk about it, but obviously she was forever in your debt. I thought, goodness, is dear old Pam finally losing her marbles? Oliver cleared his throat and shot Erica a rueful half-smile. Naturally, Erica hadn't said a word to her mother about what had happened at the barbecue. You would think it was a straightforward story, but who knew how she'd react? We were at a barbecue with the next-door neighbours and Ruby fell into a fountain, said Erica. Oliver and I sort of rescued her. We had to give her CPR. She was fine.